Start this morning by spending a few minutes with Commissioner Franz, and hopefully at the conclusion of that we're able to send his confirmation recommendation to the floor of the Senate. And so let's start this morning with Commissioner Franz, and if you can just give us a few minutes of what you've been doing the last couple of years. You have had the opportunity to serve for 2 years now. We know you've traveled a large part of the state, held a lot of meetings, and as you reached out to Minnesotans in your effort to reform and inform about Minnesota's tax system. So, Commissioner Franz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present my credentials and seek confirmation vote by this committee. I've had the pleasure, as Chair Scoie mentioned, to travel the state, and it really was a two-way street. I think for me, the opportunity to listen to Minnesotans talk about their concerns and their problems. Obviously, part of what I was doing was giving them information and facts about our current tax system and the challenges that we have, the challenges that we face going forward, both from a budget standpoint and from a revenue standpoint. And so that visiting over 50 cities, having over 160 meetings with over 7,000 Minnesotans and a lot of almost 100 legislators in the process attended many of those meetings too, that process enabled me to have a much better sense of the concerns and the perspectives that our citizens have in this state about the tax system, about our budget. And I will say that although my presentation was really focused on the tax bill, inevitably we always talked about funding and spending as well, because one of the things that Minnesotans said throughout the state was, please, let's have a budget that works, that is sustainable for both this biennium and the next. And they also talked about their particular concerns. So that was one really important avenue for me to learn about the tax system from Minnesotans. I also will tell you that I learned a lot about our current system in terms of the administration. And we got a lot of good information, a lot of feedback from people about the problems that they have, the difficulties that they're having. Because I will say, you know, about 96% of all the money that the Revenue Department collects is from voluntary compliance. And it's that incredible willingness of Minnesotans to pay what they owe, to pay it on time, that really came across. And they did challenge us to figure out better ways, more efficient ways to communicate what they owe and how they should pay. And so as one outgrowth of this talk to Minnesotans around the state has been a bigger outreach program. So we've been going out talking to different people, businesses, and folks around the state about our sales tax system, our collection system, and ways that we can make it better. And I would say that the last 2 years, what I've tried to really focus my efforts on and at the department is voluntary compliance. How can we be better educators to the public about what they owe, how they can go about paying it, and what resources that we have at the department to help them? Along the way, the governor has been really concerned about continuing to improve government services. And we at the department have received two different awards from the governor, one in 2011, in which we were able to show that we converted some of our manual check processing to electronic check processing, saving over $1 million in equipment costs and also saving over $100,000 in personnel costs every year. Then this last year in 2012, we received another governor's continuous improvement award, and that was for our efforts to take our system online with a new website and our business service component to make sure that businesses can access their records 24/7. They can make changes. They can understand what's going on a little bit better. So the goal has been to take the technology, the information that we have at the Department of Revenue, and make it available and understandable to citizens. So I think those are the areas where we've really been striving to try to be as efficient and as understandable as possible. So it's been a real pleasure to serve with the senior management team at the Department of Revenue, including Matt Mossman, Susan Von Mosch, Keith Getchell, Terry Steenblock, and Greg Cheetah. These folks have formed a really great team in supporting the efforts of the Revenue Department to deliver services as efficiently as possible. As you also know, Paul Cummings has been the legislative liaison with this committee, and those are the people who have really provided the professional support for me. So with that, Chair Skoy, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you for your service the last couple years. Been a professional presentation of information to us, the legislature, and to the public. Questions, members? Looks like you've done a pretty good job of explaining your past 2 years. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, then I have a motion to make.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Senate Tax Committee recommends confirmation of Myron Franz as Commissioner of Revenue.
Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Your confirmation will go to the floor of the Senate. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. I appreciate that vote of confidence.
And now, Commissioner, on to the meat of the day. We are going to have an opportunity to have Commissioner Franz talk about the governor's budget proposal this morning. Members, we are not going to take public testimony today. We are going to have an opportunity as we move forward this session to review a lot of this information when we actually have the bill language in front of the committee, and we will at that time take public testimony on the different provisions. Of course, there will be time for questions from members as we go through. Hopefully, we'll save most of those toward the end in the interest of time. So, Commissioner Franz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At first, I thought maybe you were going to close the committee hearing after that great vote, but I always learned as a practicing lawyer, when you're before a judge and the judge agrees with you, you should say, thank you, Your Honor, and sit down and get out of the room as quickly as possible. So, but thank you for the opportunity to talk to today about the governor's budget. I've talked to a lot of you privately, and some of you have participated in these discussions around the state. And I don't think it's any surprise that in many, many cases, what we've tried to do is to answer the question from an overall perspective. So I'll just take 1 minute to briefly introduce the governor's budget package in general, and then I'll get right away to the budget, the tax areas that we can walk through. I hope after today, as we go through and present the different details of the bill, we'll obviously be having bill language ready soon that we can go through in more detail and take public testimony. But I think one of the overriding perspectives I want to start with is the governor's concern that we fix the overall problem, that we've got to have a system where we balance the budget both in this term and in the next biennium. And in doing so, we have got to solve the $1.1 billion deficit problem. And the governor believes we also need to make investments in education and health care and jobs. And then he also believes that we have to pay back the school shift. And his budget in the next biennium in 2016 and 2017 will not only be balanced, but it will also pay back the entire $1.1 billion shift that will remain at the end of this current biennium. So the task that I think that we undertook was to solve those problems, all of those problems, and at the same time come up with a revenue system that we believe would be more fair, would provide opportunities for everyone to pay their fair share. So as we went through the budgeting process, we were constantly talking about different ways to make the system more fair, but it wasn't really until November when we had the new forecast that we realized, well, what is the target? Because I think it's important to remember that the target number or the revenue raised in the governor's tax package is designed to meet and to solve the budget problem. So it's not we weren't told to go raise a certain number. We were told to help solve the budget problem once we realized that we had the $1.1 billion deficit and what investments we wanted to make. So the budget and the tax package are designed to be a balance. It's designed to make sure we settle all of our debts. And it's designed to not have any one-time fixes so that it's balanced for the future. It's designed to be sustainable, not only for this term and the long term. It's also designed to have investments in education and job creation. And finally, it's also designed to participate in the governor's overall reform package in terms of trying to give the best value, not just for government services, but also for a tax system that is more fair. So the four areas that we discussed and came up with for the tax proposal, I'll mention the four, then I'll go into each one of them individually. The four are, first of all, was the reduction in property taxes. There are several components to that, but the overriding concern was that our continuing reliance on property taxes was causing a real problem throughout the state. We also wanted to make a change in the progressivity of the overall system, and that was primarily through the addition of a fourth tier for the top 2% income earners. We also wanted to level the playing field for businesses by eliminating some tax breaks that some companies have so that all companies pay the same lower overall corporate income tax rate. And the overall goal of these endeavors was not only to make the system balanced or fair, but also to make it balanced so that we tended to rely more evenly on all three sources of the major sources of revenue, the income tax, the property tax, and the sales tax. So I'll jump right into the property tax component first. I know you have some handouts there with the governor's changes, so I'm going to move around a little bit. I wanted to start off with the property tax first. There are three main proposals that are part of the governor's package in the tax package. And that is, the first one is a property tax rebate of up to $500 to all homeowners. There's a temporary freeze on the rate of inflation for the statewide business property tax, followed by permanent relief. And then there's increased aid to cities and counties. Let me go through each one of those separately.
Senator Chamberlain.
We're really, if you're looking Mr. Chair, Senator, if you look at these, the governor's budget pages, that has the different proponents. I'm jumping around a little bit in there, so you need to jump to the, thank you.
Members, it's the tax policy aids and credits.
I believe the property tax, Mr. Chair, starts on page, although there's no page number. It's the one, second page in. If you take all three of these mechanisms, the property tax rebate to individual homeowners, the freeze on the statewide business property tax, and the increase to cities and counties, the overall effect in calendar year 2014 would be a reduction in state and local property taxes of about 9.7%. So let's first of all start with property tax rebate for homeowners. This was designed to be something that would provide all homeowners, about 1.5 million homeowners in the state of Minnesota, with immediate and clear property tax relief. The mechanism works in that the homeowner will file on their 2014 income tax return. There'll be a new line on that form, and the homeowner will file with their income tax return a statement showing that they paid property taxes in 2013. They'll get 100% rebate of the property tax up to a maximum of $500 on their income tax return in 2014. This will continue after that. Is about a little over $700 million a year for that particular provision, about $1.4 billion in this next biennium.
Senator Rest?
Commissioner, the way it will be presented on the income tax return will show as a credit against the income tax liability, or will it be totally separately stated and people will get two checks back if they're due a refund?
Senator, it's designed to be an offset. So if someone, for example, owed no income tax, they would get a check for $500. It's fully refundable. So even if you didn't owe any income tax, you would get the $500, but it would be used as an offset on the return for other taxable income.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, unless your property tax liability was less than $500, so it would only be to the it's not refundable in and of itself. Is that correct?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's refundable of 100% of your property tax liability up to $500.
Up to $500. Okay.
Thank you. Commissioner Franz.
This would amount to about a 22% reduction in the property taxes around the state for homeowners. Now, if there are some residents who don't typically file an income tax return, they would need to do so. So we will implement a procedure to make sure that we assist individuals in filing their income tax return. One of the key areas that we were concerned about is obviously the 86% in property taxes since 2002 across the state. And I think the governor's concern was that there are different ways. We all know how complicated the property tax system can be, and there are different ways to implement refunds. But the problem with using any other mechanism is it's really difficult to understand and to see the direct effect of a immediate income or property tax rebate. So this was designed to make it really clear to the homeowners, and it's also for homeowners and the farmstead owners as well.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, since every homeowner, regardless of their income, would receive the maximum amount allowable, have you done analysis to get out the progressivity or the regressivity of this property tax rebate?
Commissioner France.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, and it is a very progressive component of the overall package. And that's one of the reasons we limited it to $500. So, for example, if you pay $1,000 in property tax and you get a rebate of $500, it's obviously a 50% reduction. If you pay $5,000 in property tax and you get the $500 rebate, then it's a 10%. So it was designed to be progressive by capping it. But making 100% of your liability up to $500, and it has a very progressive effect on the overall system.
Senator Sanjim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. And just to follow up on that a little bit, I'm just trying to formulate, maybe the first question, is there a formula someplace that we don't have to get into now, but that we could find that would kind of tell us just how this works in an intricate matter? And then the follow-up to that is does this have any, I mean, certainly it has a relationship with LGA, but does the formula that is used to implement this provision as well as then LGA, do they match up at all?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we will get to the more precise formula. Senator, it was designed independently of the local government aid because the local government aid obviously is distributed based on need, the need of some cities and their lack of tax burden to support that need locally. So this mechanism would cover all of Minnesota, whereas local government aid doesn't cover all of Minnesota. So this was designed to make an immediate, direct shift in lowering the property taxes.
And Commissioner, that would be a result of the imbalance that we see in the current revenue streams where the property tax was about 40%, and this would immediately be a reduction in that area. Is that kind of what you're driving at, Commissioner?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yes. As we mentioned before, the property tax was of the three sources of revenue, income, sales and property tax. In 1999, the property tax was about 30% of those three in relation to one another. In 2010, it was about 40%. And so one of the things that will happen at the conclusion of fiscal year 15 is that the property tax will be about 34% of the three sources of revenue, the income tax about 34%, and the sales tax about 32%, I think, if my math is right. So this restructuring that we're proposing would balance very nicely the three sources of revenue by fiscal year 2015, which is part of what we're trying to accomplish.
Senator Sanders.
And then maybe just, I think I'm going to speak the logical bit here, but this was implemented, you had a choice. You could have funded LGA with this money and worked on that formula and distributed it that way, but you elected maybe to take a broader a broader perspective on this. Is that correct, Commissioner, and just apply it to any household anywhere, and then the LGA follows up behind as an augment to property tax reduction in certain cities?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Senator, precisely one of the keys with local government aid, just like some of the other, the market value credit, for example, are hard to follow through for property taxpayers to see the direct refund or rebate and to see how that affects them. So the property tax rebate was designed to make it clear to homeowners and farm owners that here is immediate direct taxpayer relief. The local government aid that I'll talk about in just a moment is designed with a new formula to try to make a better application or distribution of those funds as well, but it is a separate mechanism designed for two different purposes.
Senator Senjum, not everybody lives in a city that
right.
gets
yeah.
LGA.
So.
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, one of the other issues that we wanted to bring up at this point, too, is, as we all know, we have a very robust property tax refund mechanism for based on income, and that is the renter's refund credit and the homeowner credit. The governor recommends fully funding those two mechanisms in their current form, and because they are income-based, they're targeted, and we wanted to make sure that there was support for those. But we wanted to provide not only that relief, but also the direct property tax relief for both for homeowners and for businesses that I'll get to in just a moment.
Senator Rest.
So, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, so these are additive. They're not, they don't offset one another at all. I mean, some people are getting more than $500, obviously, on the M1PR, but they get both. Is that right?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is correct, and there is some overlap.
And, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, will the rebate be considered an addition to income when figuring out the M1PR in the next year?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think the answer to that is no, but I have to double-check on that, the interaction portion.
Right. Thank you.
The other component when we're talking about, before I get to the local government aid, is the business statewide property tax freeze. So the way that this would work is that beginning in 2014, the inflation adjuster would not go into effect for 2 years. So right now, as you all know, businesses pay their property tax bill. About 30% of their property tax bill goes to the statewide business property tax. And right now, that particular tax increases by inflation every year. This is the way it's been for almost the last 10 years. So what this proposal would do would be to take that inflation adjuster for 2014 and 2015 and freeze it. There would be no increase in the statewide business property tax because of the inflation adjuster. And then, beginning in 2016 and going forward, there would be a permanent reduction in the rate, inflation rate itself, and instead of being adjusted each year by inflation, it would be adjusted upward by half of inflation. So we would reduce that increase to 50% of inflation beginning in 2016. We believe this is one way to try to reduce the tax burden directly on property tax, business property tax owners, especially small businesses. We believe that through 2017, fiscal year 2017, businesses will save over $120 million through this provision. The cost to the state in the first fiscal year, this first biennium, excuse me, is about $25.1 million. The final portion of the property tax component relates to local government aid and county program aid. The governor proposes increasing local government aid by $80 million to cities beginning in 2014 and $40 million to county program aid beginning in 2014 as well. That's about a 19% increase to city government aid and about a 24% increase to county program aid. The main policy reason for this was to try to provide some opportunities for local governments who have seen significant reductions in the last decade for reductions in local government aid that they've had to address. They've had to cut services. they've been faced with the challenge of either cutting services or raising property taxes or a combination of both. So this is an opportunity, we think, to provide some funding issues for communities going forward. And as Chair Scoy mentioned a little bit ago, obviously local government aid doesn't go everywhere. Local government aid is designed to address inequities that we have in our tax system and need. There are some communities that over the years, as a policy matter, we have decided they have a certain need, an overburden, if you will, and they don't have the sufficient tax base to support that need. Now, one of the things that's exacerbated that is the property tax increases the last decade. So what we're going to be proposing is not only an additional investment in local government aid and county program aid, but also a new formula that we'll be prepared to discuss in detail, not today, but at another time, to try to make the formula work in a more predictable fashion, in one that's more easily understandable, and hopefully that will address how do we define what cities are in need, and then obviously you take that need, once you define the need, you match it up to the property tax base. Do they have the property tax capacity to fund those needs? I mean, part of the difficulty for some cities across the state, whether they have an old infrastructure or whether they have a lot of exempt property or whether they're having a lot of growth that's hard to sustain, they get into these situations where their needs are really outpacing their local property tax ability to fund that. So we wanted to make sure that we had an opportunity to address that issue. We had 15 mayors from around the city help participate in putting together this formula and talking about it. And so I think I look forward to a discussion about with this committee about how we go about distributing that the local government aid as we go forward. We do have in your package, we do have some sample runs of the distribution that would occur under the governor's formula that we hope you'll take time to look at and that we can discuss in more detail once you've had a chance to review that. I'd like to move on. Yes,
Commissioner, on the aid formula, maybe when you are back in front of this committee, specifically talking about the new formula, you would also be prepared, or have somebody on your team prepared, to talk about some of the problems with the current formula, because that's part of why we're looking so seriously at some new formula. Also, Commissioner and members, if I could ask, of course, we're going to look at spreadsheets on this, but let's, as Senator Rest has been doing in the division, have a policy discussion about the formula and the need factors that fit into the formula first, and see if we can come around with that assessment, and then we'll start making sure that the distribution is equitable. We all know that the distribution has to work for everybody or it isn't going to fly, so we'll figure that stuff out. But let's have a pretty vigorous policy discussion first, and that would include some of the problems with the current formula. Commissioner, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, it's a good point to make about the current frustration over the current formula. It's been in place for a long time and clearly needs some adjustments. And I think that was one of the impetus for us to come forward with a new proposal was that everyone was pretty much agreed that the current formula wasn't working. And so we'll see if everyone can agree whether our formula does it or not. But I think you're right. If we can have that debate and a good discussion about how do we go about making these decisions, we look forward to that discussion. I'd like to turn to the income tax. That's on page one, the first page.
Mr. Chair, would it be appropriate at this time to just ask a couple more questions on the property tax piece before we move on to the income tax piece?
Sure, Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, just quickly, I think we all agree there's been property tax working groups. I think Senator Scoy was on it for years. The stuff I've reviewed has been the same result over 40 years, but that being the case, we'd agree that the Minnesota property tax system is one of the most complicated in the country, right? We have five classes and then numerous subclasses, and we don't operate off the mill rate. On top of that, for the first quick question, did the governor take into consideration in his property tax reform any of the reform recommendations put out by that committee, that task force?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, we did. And it was really helpful, frankly, to have the report of the working group. I will say this, that one of our primary goals as we talked to citizens around the state and learned of their concern about the complexity in general about our tax system, but in particular about the property tax system, was a desire for simplification. And we looked really closely at trying to make some of those adjustments. And I will give you quite candidly, our analysis was that we wanted to do that, but it just costs too much money. Part of the problem with simplification is that it really makes changes that can be felt across the spectrum of homeowners and business property owners. So one of the things we looked at was eliminating some of the classes, trying to consolidate some of the classes, making them more predictable and understandable. But in the final analysis, and certainly something we want to look at going forward, but in the final analysis, the governor's decision was the first thing we need to do is address the over-reliance on property tax. And the second thing we need to do, if not this session, the next session, is to look more detailed in terms of simplification. But we certainly are open to discussing simplification issues. The challenge, I think, and this is a challenge we're going to have throughout this debate this morning and the rest of the session, the challenge will be for us to do that in a way that can still make this budget work. And so I am fully embracing the opportunity to have those discussions with you about different ways to add simplification. It is important, and it was simply one of those things that we felt was secondary to getting the rate, the overall burden reduced.
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up.
Senator Chamberlain, we will hear those reports in the committee. Yeah. I don't have the schedule in front of me. Senator Chamberlain.
This is a quick follow-up to it. Now, you in your presentation here, you talked about how much money this freeze and then the 0.5% reduction on the inflator for the statewide business property tax would save businesses. It certainly doesn't simplify it for them. They certainly had to make accommodations for that, and it's still a very costly piece of legislation and tax for the businesses. But while it might save money there, would you comment on the fact that we're also the other part of the tax plan that relates to this? When you say it saves them money, we're removing exemptions and deductions on the income tax side, and we're also going to plan on taxing business-to-business services. So how does that save money in the end? What's the net effect of that? Thank you.
Well, Senator, we'll get to some of those as we go through the presentation, but Commissioner, if you want to answer that.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yeah, I think one of the things that we will try to take a look at as we get toward the end here is to look at the offsetting issues. And I think that was one of the keys that we tried to put together a package where there's a opportunity for businesses in different ways. Lowering the corporate income tax rate, we felt, was an important step in making sure businesses had some opportunities to reduce the taxes, income taxes that they pay. The business-wide property tax was another area we wanted to see where property taxes could come down for businesses. And also the investment in local government aid is another place. About half that money is projected to be will result in property tax or refunds. So I think one of the issues that we wanted to do was to try to make sure that businesses do have some opportunities. It is true that under the sales tax proposal, I'll get to a little bit more in detail, does provide some more opportunities for business to pay their fair share. It also provides some offsets. Well, I'll talk a little bit more about that at that time, if that's all right, Senator.
Yeah. And Commissioner, if I could add something on the business statewide business property tax. While I think we all kind of recognize that's a little cumbersome tax policy because the property tax is supposed to be a local tax, that was done in conjunction of a larger property tax plan. And the businesses received significant rate compression when that was done, and they also were removed from portions of the school levy. So there was that balance that was going on in the tax bill that was being worked on, and I think that was 2003 or one. I don't remember exactly when it was. But so we'll take that into consideration as we're examining this statewide business portion. And the other thing about the simplification that, you know, we haven't talked a little bit about, and is not part of the governor's proposal, but maybe if we can figure out a way to undo that value exclusion. that was added a couple years ago that's also a complicating factor to the property taxes. Maybe we can figure out some of that this year also. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question about that LGA formula just in general as I'm looking at your pro forma kind of spreadsheet. When we are considering the change in the factors that the governor is proposing relative to what we now have, I see that, like, there's a change per capita from 2013 is like 30, but I will be interested when we get into a further discussion of that to see how that additional 30 the distributional effects of that against the current law. I don't know if that's because if the current formula is out of whack, then merely presenting an additional amount of dollars per capita doesn't get us into, in my mind, a discussion of why the factors that you're now proposing are superior. So when we do have that discussion, I hope that you will. You don't have to do it now, but that you will address those issues.
Mr. Chair, Senator,
Commissioner.
Yeah, that's a great. We will go through that comparison. I think that's an important point.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Artman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, Commissioner, and congratulations on the vote on your confirmation. We had some really tough traffic problems between here and Chanhassen. So, about the property tax questions, you gave a presentation. Or the budget, the governor's budget had some tax proposals with a presentation in it, and there were a couple of slides in there that related to property tax that I wanted to ask you about. The first one was a slide that showed an 86% increase in property taxes in the state of Minnesota, and I just wanted to point out that that was not indexed for inflation, and the numbers that went in also were for all types of property, not just residential, but agricultural, commercial, industrial, residential property. And the third thing I wanted to point out about that slide, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it didn't make any acknowledgement of the valuation changes, that it was just straight line increases in property taxes, so that when inflation was occurring, valuations were adjusting up and down, way up for ag, down for others, that was not taken into account with that slide. That's correct, isn't it, Commissioner?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Senator, well, thank you, first of all, for the and I do know the ice was a challenge even in my backyard in Minneapolis as well. Luckily, I saw someone fall before I made my first step, so I was careful. But thank you for making it. Today, I one of the things that chart is you're right. For example, on the indexing, if you index the increase for property taxes both to inflation and to population, I think the overall increase is something in the 20% range. So that, you're right, it's a straight line increase from 2002 without indexing or for inflation or population. And it does consider all types of property, and the valuation issue was not taken out of that chart. That's correct.
Mr. Chair,
can I just follow up and then come back to you, Senator Armin? So, Commissioner, so what you just said is that if a property is taxed on the value increases, the property taxes are going up faster than if they're taxed on an indexing formula. Did I hear that properly?
Mr. Chair, the chart was measuring the total increase in taxes paid, so it's without regard to the valuation. As we know, for the first part of that period, there was increasing values, and then after the recession, we have the combination of decreasing values. So that the fluctuation of values up for a while, then down for a while, was not factored into that increase.
Senator Artman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the idea that there was a tax reduction when you factor in the LGA, the CPA, and also the rebate really isn't anything but a one-time reduction. If the counties and cities extend that full portion of the CPA and LGA into the taxpayers' pockets and into a reduction of their taxes, and then you factor in the $500 rebate. I just want to make sure that people understand that we're talking about a one-time assumption that there will be a reduction of taxes when you say that there was a 9.7% effect. It wouldn't carry over from year to year, and it would factor in that one payment of $500 when you come up with that 9.7%. Is that correct?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Senator, actually that would be an annual amount. So the rebate begins in 2014 and continues thereafter. So the 9.7% reduction in state property taxes would be a result of the $500 rebate program beginning and continuing in 2014. And the same is true of the local government aid. It would be a result of the local government aid, and the assumption about half of that would go toward property tax reduction. And it will also be an effect of the statewide property tax reduction as well. So all three of those factors would attribute to the 9.7% decrease in 2014, but it would continue thereafter based on other projections.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Artman.
Commissioner, are you saying that then you're planning to provide that rebate more than one time?
Yeah,
Commissioner Franz.
Senator Scoia, yes, it's an ongoing rebate program beginning in 2014.
Well, forgive me for being skeptical, Mr. Chair.
Senator Artman.
And Commissioner Franz, especially in the last couple of years, residential property taxes have not gone up statewide. Now, I'm concerned about the statewide business property tax, but I can't imagine why we would take sales tax dollars out of the pockets of middle income and poor Minnesotans just to write a check to property tax owners or property owners in the state of Minnesota. I don't know why we would do that unless it looked like a forgive me for being cynical, a reelection plan. I'm not sure why that's good tax policy. Why would you raise sales taxes and income taxes just to write a check to certain Minnesotans who happen to own property?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the policy was designed based upon our feedback and analysis of citizens across the state of Minnesota, and their concern, their number one concern about property taxes becoming too high, becoming too continuing to rise, and they were first of all, that was our number one concern. The second thing is the fact that we've continued to rely more and more on property taxes. So this is both an effort to make sure that Minnesotans, both businesses and homeowners, get some relief from property tax increases, and we provide a mechanism where the sales tax shoulders a bigger share of the responsibility for funding government. So in terms of trying to solve the budget problem, make investments, and make sure that we had a sustainable budget system, we wanted to make sure that homeowners, the governor was really concerned that homeowners could see that they were getting some relief for property taxes, and in addition, the shift to more and more sales tax, from our analysis, will show that middle-class citizens will not pay more under the sales tax expansion. In fact, we'll get to that a little bit more in detail later on when we'll walk through the sales tax component, but our analysis shows that for the average typical consumer, the sales tax reduction from 6.875 to 5.5%, that reduction in what's currently being paid is enough to offset any additional taxes that are due for items that are added for the typical consumer. Obviously, businesses will pay more on the business-to-business services. So this does not hit the sales tax does not hit middle income. The property tax was designed to make sure every homeowner, 1.5 million homeowners, see some property tax relief, and the businesses see property tax relief. So that was a policy behind the property tax component.
And, Mr. Commissioner, when we get to the sales tax portion, you'll have an opportunity to talk about the $100 and the rationale behind that.
Yes.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, my point also goes to the property tax and the broad policy pieces. I'm trying to understand when property taxes are determined at the local level based upon the spending decisions of the local municipality or county, how can you guarantee that people's property taxes are actually going to decrease, or they'll feel less of a pain in their pocket when they write out that property tax check. It seems to me the only thing we can guarantee is that the state of Minnesota will lessen your burden by $500. In other words, we'll send you a check for up to $500 to pay for those property tax bills that we all feel so vividly when we write out that check. But my question is, what has history shown us? I mean, there's been other times where we've where the state has gone in and tried to buy down property taxes. And I'm just wondering, what's the history been on that? I think the most recent one that I can recall is the 2001, where we kind of we took over that general ed levy. And it seems to me that actually cities and counties actually increased their levies instead of decreasing them at that time. And I don't know, there was the 71 Minnesota Miracle. I don't recall that. Or in 67, I think there was some other tax reform where we tried to buy down business property taxes, certainly a laudable goal. But I'm just not sure if having the state write a check for $500 to each property tax holder actually does decrease property taxes and our reliance on those. So how are you going to guarantee that when actually we don't control the spending mechanism for property taxes? That's all decided at the local level. So how do you get there?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Senator, well, first of all, you know, we can control part of it, the statewide business property tax. And so that's one mechanism is for us to try to provide relief there. I think the second part of it in terms of the local government aid and the local decisions made by those local units of government, we have a very interesting relationship here in this state with the state government and the local units of government deciding on property taxes. I think one of the things we have to come to rely on and put confidence in is that local officials will make those decisions. We can't guarantee that without levy restrictions, but what we can do, and I think what the citizens around the state are doing, is making sure that city officials, county officials, township officials, school district officials are careful in how they spend money. So it's important that those decisions are made at the local level. We don't intend to overtake that decision-making, but I think it's important that we have this discussion. I think that around this state, I think a lot of local communities will have to make those hard choices, because I think we hope to make sure that the public is expecting the $500 rebate, and in fact they're going to expect the taxes will not go up in an attempt to sort of capture that back, if you will, at the local level. So it depends upon the relationship we all have with the local units of government. We have confidence that those decisions will be made, you know, at the local level where they need to be made, and the local officials will be held accountable for those changes.
And just kind of out to the public here while we're talking about local governments, maybe the mayors and city council members, county commissioners that are planning on coming and talking to the tax committee as we do this aids and credit discussion would be willing to bring what kind of increases in expenditures you have had occurred the last number of years. My recollection is it's a single digit or quite small, but perhaps you could offer some verification of that. And the other thing, you know, Senator Benson, these aids and credits are also an effort to have some comparability of services afforded across the state so that people have some expectation that the services, while they're not going to be equal, they might be comparable. Senator
Skoy, thank you for the recognition. I guess, and this might not be the form, but maybe it will be at the later hearing with the council members and the mayors, but I would like to know historically what has our track record been. As we have in the past, the state has stepped in an effort to try and reduce property taxes. I think it's incumbent on all of us to know what's our track record been. In other words, have we done that in the past? Have our efforts to reduce property taxes by the state stepping in to buy those down, has it really helped? And if it hasn't, then I would like to know what's different about this proposal. And could we get to that at the proper forum, please?
Sure. And Senator Nelson, I think the department will probably come at some point and talk about how they analyze the impact of aids and credits on property taxes. I think they used to count about two-thirds of it as property tax relief. I understand now they're down to around half. We do know that actions that the state takes impact property taxes that local governments have made no levy adjustments and property taxes change. And if we just look back a couple years, There were many jurisdictions in my Senate district that had zero levy increases voted by their boards, but they saw significant property tax changes. And it was because the state backed away from some of its funding of a property tax relief program that was working, from what I was seeing, pretty effectively. One more, Senator.
Yeah, thank you. And just to follow up on that, yes, I understand that, and certainly many of the cities that I represent do have that LGA and county program aid, as important as that is.
Somebody's got to cut the cell phone, please. Senator Nelson.
But I think to a broader point, this particular proposal extends to all property tax holders in all cities, whereas LGA, county program aid, only goes, LGA particularly, only goes to certain cities. And so the real nub of my question is, even though, let's set LGA aside, let's just look at those areas that don't receive LGA. Has the state, as we have stepped in and tried to buy down business property taxes, has it worked in the past? That's kind of the gist of my question.
Yeah,
thank you.
Senator Nelson, I think we're going to have a really good discussion about this as we go through the details of these committee bills. You know, there are other ways to offer property tax relief, school funding. I mean, there's all kinds of things that I'm hopeful that this committee is willing to discuss.
Thank you.
I've got a list, so I'm going to work down it. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, if I understood you correctly, Commissioner, basically what you're saying in response to Senator Nelson's question is, well, we hope to work with these officials to be reasonable and not raise taxes based on our rebate. And yet it seems to me that the whole premise of the rebate is that somehow local governments have done it incorrectly. They've raised too much money. They've raised the property taxes. They're screwing it up, for lack of a better term. But now all of a sudden, because we mail a $500 check out to property owners, now they're going to be reasonable and not raise taxes to compensate for that. We don't have control over that, again, unless we start putting, you know, really draconian limits on what local governments can do. The bottom line is we really have no idea what several years down the road the overall impact on property tax is going to be, Dewey.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would disagree with your premise. I think one of the things that when we talk to cities and county and school officials, we have found that they have struggled mightily this last decade with the struggles that we've had to have here at the state level. And that is reduced funding, reduced local government aid, and sometimes even after they've made their budget, the states reduce the aid to some cities. So they have struggled like we all have this last decade after coming out of the dot-com bubble burst in 2000 and the recession we went through there, and then the next major recession in 2008. So I think they've all been challenged. I think we've all faced some real difficult challenges, and so I don't think we at all think that they've messed it up. On the contrary, I think they've taken a very difficult situation and done, in many cases, the best that they could do. And I know they continue to struggle with those issues. Everything that I hear from the local officials is that they've cut and cut and have reduced services, and they really are at the bottom of what they think they can do in most cases. And I'm not saying we can't always find savings in some places or some cities or counties couldn't do better. I'm not saying that. What I am saying, though, is that we believe that these county and city and township and school officials have the best interests of their constituents at heart. They're struggling with difficult issues, and we've made it a tough decade for them. And what we're trying to do here is provide some relief, not only to them through local government aid where it's directed, but also through the homeowners to give them some direct relief as well. And I think part of the problem that we see going forward is trying to develop a revenue system that is interrelated at the state and local level, works together to come up with these solutions. So we would envision working very closely and trying to help local and city county agencies have ways to solve their budget problems. But I'm sure that's part of the discussion we'll have here. And we're more than open to discussions about how do we work with local units of government to ensure that they're spending wisely. But those are elected officials. They have a job to do. And what we're trying to do with our budget is to make sure that they've got some of the tools. And we think one of the tools they haven't had, frankly, is a more adequate funding stream.
Senator Thompson.
Follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. All right, let's, you know, I tend to really like local government, and I wish we'd push a lot more down to local government to handle and put a lot less mandates on all kinds of things that would allow them to keep their taxes lower. So assume you're right that we're not going to presume that local governments aren't doing it correctly, that it's just the result of outside pressures. My point is still the same. We're raising taxes at the state level in a big way. We're raising them on businesses, which, of course, will be passed on to consumers, because ultimately businesses, as you well know with your background, they're simply a conduit to pay the tax. And frankly, I would hope that at some point we'd see a tax incidence study on these business-to-business taxes, because we know ultimately consumers end up paying those. So my point is, we got a big tax increase coming at the state level on high-income earners, on business-to-business transactions that ultimately flow to consumers, on consumers directly through a broadened base of the sales tax. And the trade-off is the $500 check going back to property owners, and yet we have no control over what – let me restate that – limited control, and we shouldn't take control over what local governments do. So we can guarantee folks the tax increase, but we can't guarantee them the tax relief. And to me, that seems like a pretty precarious position to put our taxpayers in.
Was there a question there?
No.
Senator Artman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it might be effective campaign speech to say that property taxes went up over the last year, but that's just absolutely not true. They actually went down statewide, and facts do matter. And in the last 2 years, we actually increased property tax relief. We actually increased it by $30 million. So very effective campaign speech, but just not the facts here. And I would point out, I'm glad that the governor recognizes that property tax relief should go directly to the homeowner or the property taxpayer, and not get it all confused and lumped together with aid to local governments because of the transparency issue. You want those local government officials to be accountable to the property taxpayers, but in this case, like in other instances in the governor's budget and tax policies in particular, he gets the worst of both. Now he's sending money to the property taxpayer and also sending more aid to the cities and counties, more complexity for the property taxpayer to understand who's raising their property taxes or lowering their property taxes. No connection whatsoever, because now we've got another huge rebate program that you're saying is expected to be permanent. And I don't know how you can possibly make that a sustainable program at $700 million in new spending. I mean, that's an awful lot to say we're going to spend over and over and over again to fund these property tax rebate programs, and now we've confused those relationships completely. So I'm not sure that this is really good policy. It's certainly not continuing what we really had started last year, was trying to establish stability in the LGA and the CPA programs. That was a very important goal, was to say, look, cities and counties, we're not going to promise you a whole bunch more aid that we can't deliver time after time after time. And so we maintained CPA and LGA since 2010 at the exact same levels. And now the governor is saying, well, let's promise some more. But they had just learned to realize that the stability was far more important than another empty promise from the state and another roller coaster ride in their budget when they decide to rely on it or not rely on it. And so I think we're going in the wrong direction here, Commissioner. There are a couple of pieces of it that the governor gets right, but I hope you'll go back and look at it again before you introduce even one bill and try and identify what goals we're trying to accomplish here. Is it stability? Is it transparency? Is it simplification? Because to me, all three of those are out of whack here.
Commissioner France.
Mr. Chair, Senator, well, I appreciate your concerns, and I think you are right in that we will engage in that dialogue. That's the governor's plan, is to listen to all your concerns and take those seriously and go through this process in an open fashion. I think one of the things that I've learned from Governor Dayton time and time again is he always says, if there's a better idea out there, let's grab it wherever it comes from. So really our perspective has been to, and putting together the budget, is to try to make things as transparent as we can. I mean, that's one of the reasons for the property tax rebate, in terms of a direct and both the property tax rebate and the statewide business property tax to make a direct connection to business homeowners and businesses that there is property tax relief. But the goal really is tough because we have to both solve the deficit, make investments we think we haven't been making in the last decade, and to solve the budget going forward. So the challenges that we all face are being prudent in terms of solving the deficit, making investments to make Minnesota continue to be great, and then also making sure the next biennium we not only have a sustainable budget, but we can pay back the school shift. So those challenges are the nature of how we approach this solution. And I understand that I'm glad to hear that some parts of it may be acceptable. But, you know, we hope to prepare a bill that does reflect the governor's thinking here, and then we can have a robust debate on going forward.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A comment on how the and then a question. Comment on how the cities have understood local government aid over the last 10 years has, in my mind, and what I hear from my communities is they've never trusted the state government to do anything that lasted more than 1 year. And that for some of them, the local government aid that they get, they set aside. They don't depend on it. They do their budgets totally independent of whatever local government aid they may or may not get because they can't put it as part of their budget, and they put it into some sort of sinking fund or whatever and use it for one-time purchases like a fire truck or something. But they don't use it. They don't use it as part of their budgeting. And then, so that's just a comment on at least how I see some of my communities dealing with the reliability of state government and also the attitude of state government that we're not in this together, that somehow the local governments are the enemy rather than partner in providing services to our constituents. But then my question is, you've gone around the state for months and months and months. How many times when you made your presentation to the people that came to your presentations, did someone say to you, don't change a thing? It's just perfect the way it is right now. It's fair. It is. It funds what we need to fund. Don't change anything. It's not broken. Could you comment on how many times you heard people say that to you?
Commissioner Franz.
Senator Scoy, Chair Scoy, Senator, thank you. Well, never. And as Governor Dayton has said many times the last few weeks, especially the last week, is he feels like he wouldn't be a governor if people were satisfied with the tax system, and then some of the folks in the legislature might not be here either. And the point being that the discussion was robust, and it was absolutely a wonderful experience for me to hear from Minnesotans. And the dialogue was so interesting because I have to tell you, when I first started working on this and our team put together this show about the problems, I thought, well, who's going to want to come and listen to a stodgy old commissioner like me talk about tax policy? Well, a lot of people did, and a lot of people, they were so appreciative of the presentation of the facts. So here are the trends, because what we tried to do was present the trends. What's happening demographically? What's happening to our economy? And they all listened very intently, and they all gave great advice, and to a T, they all said it is broken, and we need to fix it. So I would say the number one thing I did hear was they expect us collectively, you policy leaders, the governor, to put together something that does work. People really are upset about the system. They don't think the tax system is fair, but on a broader level even, they're concerned that the deficit, the budgeting process is broken, and that, you know, nine deficits in the last 11 years doesn't instill confidence in our citizens. And they expect us to solve that in a way that is meaningful both in this biennium and the next biennium. So it was a very robust discussion, and I always heard about the problems and the concerns. And there were sometimes people would say, oh, this is a mess, and please just go. You guys are smart, meaning all of us are smart, not me included. Why don't you all just fix it? So, I mean, I think there is a – I'll tell you, the challenge coming back isn't to me so much as it is to the governor and to you all to get their confidence back, that we can get together here, we can make some decisions for the long term that they'll appreciate. So thank you for the question, Senator, but it was – people are concerned, and there, you know, there are different levels of anxiety, but there's plenty of anxiety over there about the tax system.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine is more of a comment and a question for you as we further these discussions and look into LGA and the formula on LGA. I'd also like to, if it's possible, when we discuss county program aid, also what services the counties are mandated to provide and that we mandate they provide, and then what percentage does county program aid cover for that. And then as we go on into discuss the sales tax, not just how it impacts families and consumers and businesses, but local government units.
And Senator, perhaps when we're talking about the county program aid, and we could look at some of the administrative costs that have been moved from the state to the counties and try to get our arms around some of those issues also. So for the county folks out there, if you want to think about that. Should we move on, Commissioner?
Are we still on the same topic, Mr. Chair?
I think we are. Let's.
Yes, thank you. Let's shift to the income tax, if we can, for a moment, Mr. Chair. That's on the beginning of the tax policy and aids credits handout. The governor, as you know, proposed a new fourth tier. The tax rates in 1999 and 2000 had the top rate at 8.5%, and it was reduced in those 2 years down to 7.85%. So what the governor is proposing is that there would be a new fourth tier that would begin at $250,000 for married filing joint, $200,000 for head of household, and $150,000 for individuals. Now, that's taxable income. Typically, I'll give you an example, a family of four, a married couple and with two kids, a family of four, would often have about $306,000 in total household income or gross income that would equate to about $250,000 in taxable income. That obviously varies from family to family. Our estimate is that a typical individual would have about $179,000 in gross income, total income as an individual, and they would typically, after deductions, exemptions, and credits, have about $150,000 in taxable income. We believe that this will impact about a little over 2% of the resident Minnesota returns. This would begin in this year in 2013. The average amount that would be paid by a top income earner would be about a little over $7,000. But in order to pay that average amount, you would have to have total taxable income of at least $612,000 as a married couple and $512,000 as an individual. So under this proposal, about 98% of the returns, there would be no increase in income taxes for other Minnesotans. It would be a 2% addition, so that beginning with the income above this amount, the tax rate would be 9.85% going forward. The total amount raised is about $1.1 billion in this biennium. We think that about 94% of small businesses that have positive income, I'll get to the number of entities out there in just a moment, but about 94% of those small businesses that have positive income would not pay any more under this fourth tier, that their income would be below these levels, so only 6% of those small businesses would pay any additional tax.
Mr. Chair, could you say that one? Can you say that one again?
Senator Sanjum?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator.
Hey, Commissioner. I'll
try to be a little bit more clear. So,
I think you were clear. I just needed to hear it twice, make sure I heard it.
For those small businesses that have positive income, and not all small businesses have positive income, but for those that do have what we determine to be positive income on their return, about 94% of those would not pay any additional tax under this proposal because their total income would still be below the $250,000 taxable income or whatever.
Thank you.
Commissioner Franz, is there any capability within the department to start ascertaining some of the types of businesses that fall into that category, and maybe we could get some information on that sometime in the future? And one other little bit of information I think that would be informative for the committee, you know, we've had the discussion about the history of the property tax and LGA and that so far this morning, but maybe when we're delving into this a little more, a little history of Minnesota's published tax rate and effective tax rate. I know in the 90s, I think that the state was authorized to go to 17%, but went to about a 16% published top rate. I think the effective rate was around 11. So if we could get a little history of that, would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to do that. I actually had the opportunity to attend an editorial board meeting with the governor last week where he had that information himself. Our tax booklet obviously has that pretty well laid out, and he had gone through that and was looking at that himself. So we will present that. I think it's helpful to see the history of where we've been and how we're going forward. Let me just give you a little data on the number of different kinds of entities. This is for 2010. So we have about 35,600 C corporations in the state of Minnesota. So when we come back and talk more detail about how this ripples through, we'll have more information. And I'll talk a little bit about the C corporations in just a minute under the corporate income tax proposal. We have about 100,000 S corporations, flow-through entities. We have about 62,000 partnership returns, another flow-through entity. And there's about 362,000 sole proprietors. Those are people who file the schedule on their personal return and claim their business income on their personal return. So we'll work through some of these numbers and show you how the income tax affects some of these different entities. But it is complicated. It's sometimes hard to follow that through. I'm ready to move on to
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you know, we would prefer that businesses make a choice on how they're organized on factors other than their tax treatment. And a couple of years ago, there was a tax study group that came in and presented their findings that recommended lowering the corporate tax rate, which the governor is doing here as well, but that to make it to reduce the consideration of organizing differently, they also proposed a deduction or a subtraction of the pass-through income, of a certain percentage of the pass-through income, so that the change in the treatment of the corporate tax rate would not drive businesses which had previously organized either as sole proprietorships. Did you mention that group? Sole proprietorships or S-corps or LLCs or partnerships or whatever, and I wonder if in the business tax relief proposals, if you had considered that as a in conjunction with lowering the corporate tax rate.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think my answer to most of your questions about have we considered will be yes, because I can tell you honestly that we really took a look at everything we could in putting this package together. With respect to the business entity decision and how people form their different businesses, now we're getting into a realm of tax policy that is more near and dear to my heart as a former tax lawyer, but I think One of the things that we sometimes need to do is to compare the C Corp, the larger corporation, with these pass-through entities, the S Corps, the partnerships. Because at the C Corp level, remember, there is two levels of taxation. So the C Corporation, if it has $1 million in taxable income, it will be taxed at the corporate rate, and the federal has a tax on that as well. It will be taxed based on corporate income, corporate profits, after all the deductions and everything. But at the flow-through entity for the partnerships and the S-Corps, they're not taxed at the entity level. So when they get their profits, when they determine their profits, and maybe it's, you know, $50,000 per partner or per member of an LLC, that LLC member will get that tax statement for their return, and they will conclude that profit on their return, and they'll pay tax on that business profit on their return. So it is a tax-favored institution to begin with, in the sense there's only taxation at the one level. Now, the other thing that we did look at is the complicating factor of, in some flow-through businesses, there are situations where you as a partner might receive a $50,000 K-1 or a partnership return and or K-1 from an LLC, and saying that you have $50,000 in profit, but in fact you didn't get all that in cash because you've reinvested some of it in the business. It's a difficult endeavor to try to figure out ways to address that issue in terms of how do you adjust for the fact that some of the returns are, you know, invested back into the business, which is often a good thing, obviously. And we clearly want to support business owners in making those investments. And I think one of the things that we've struggled with is how to do that in a way that does not incredibly complex and yet deals with that issue. So we struggled with that. We didn't make any proposals along that line, and it's something I think we can talk about as we go forward.
Senator Rest.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, there's some actions of those other entities that are taxed at the entity level. It's not everything deductions and income flow through to the partners or the shareholders, so that, you know, that's another complicating factor in that whole area of taxing the income of business enterprises.
Yep. And Senator S., the other thing that I would speculate that many of these closely held businesses do is when the partners or the shareholders see that profit flowing through to their personal return, the business then calculates the tax and makes the payment to them in the form of salary, which they then can deduct, and it helps the member with their, you know, their personal income tax. So there's all kinds of things that can go on there internally to help the shareholders or the owners.
But Mr. Chairman, when we're going to, in this proposal, flip-flop the relationship between the corporate income tax rate, the marginal rate, the statutory rate, whatever, and which does make a difference, and the personal income tax rate, then in some businesses that is it's a huge red flag for influencing the way in which they're going to organize. And I think we should embrace that, if we do, with our eyes wide open about the impact that it's going to have on the businesses that are organized with flow-through income. That's all.
And Senator, as your point is that we don't want to be making actions that have businesses do things for tax purposes. They should be doing things for business purposes.
That's my point.
Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, last time I read through the tax incident report, I understand that the report is about studying the impact of taxes on businesses and how that essentially most of that flows through, and I think someone said it earlier, lower wages and higher prices for individuals. So ultimately the rest of us pay that. But on the other part of the incident study that I recall is that we separate into the deciles, you know, 10%. The first decile, they really can't count the data that is discarded because they have so many other types of income coming in through state support, et cetera, that it can't be quantified. So the bottom decile is basically eliminated from the discussion, and it makes that disclaimer on a few pages after that those numbers are laid out. The other part of it, I understand, if I recall correctly, the incident study has got the impact of sales tax, property tax, and then income tax. And certainly the sales tax being the most regressive of all taxes, and we're raising those taxes on everybody, and the property taxes being a little less regressive as well. But the income tax clearly was progressive as it was, because as everybody in here knows, when you get to a certain level, you suffer the impact of AMT. And Minnesota and the feds start to eliminate all those other deductions so that everybody's paying their fair share. So the last part of my point here is that they did this in California, Maryland, Oregon. I'm sure you're aware. And the studies and the research and the data they had from those states, especially from Maryland Oregon still has a high rate, they found that they increased those rates, but they did not get the return they expected because people with those resources are able to move those dollars around and find ways to avoid the oppressive taxes. So in essence, your numbers here of, 2014-15 and 16-17 show increases over the years, over the bienniums, in those taxes collected in the 2%. I would highly doubt that that's going to be the case. And in fact, I've talked to many people personally who said they're going, they're not staying. They've put their house on the market. Now that's anecdotal stuff, but it is true. So the instant study, Maryland, California, Oregon. Last piece, and the question is there still something in here about the snowbird, the so-called snowbird tax? And could you comment on that, please?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Senator. Well, first of all, I'll tackle the incidence report numbers that you mentioned. One of the things that the department does every 2 years, as you reference, is the incidence study, which will be out sometime in March, the new one. So the last one we did, it was published in 2011, was for the last year was 2008, and then it projects some information for 2013. So the new one that will be coming out in the month or so will be for 2010 and project to 2015. And, one of the things that we've talked about based on the last incidence report is that we talk to people, we try to measure, as you indicated, the incidence of tax. Where is the tax burden felt throughout our state in terms of the property tax, the income tax, the sales tax, and other taxes like motor vehicle taxes, alcohol taxes, tobacco taxes? So it measures all these taxes that we levy here in Minnesota and figures out how much does each household based on income decile pay. And that's where the governor talks a lot about the folks in the middle pay about 12.3% of their total household income to these four areas of taxation, total taxation, and the top 2% pay about 9.7%. But just a little bit more information about that, and this is from page 27 of the incidence report. You can see that when you compare the overall income versus tax payments, that if you take a look, and this is just the way it's broken down in the book, if you take a look at the top decile, the 10th decile, in Minnesota, the total household income in Minnesota for 2008 was estimated to be something like $173 million. Million? That's right. $173 million. A billion. It's got to be billion. I'm sorry. It's billion, isn't it? Make sure I got the right. Yes, I'm sorry. Got to have the right decimal point here. About $173 billion in total income in Minnesota for 2008. Of that, the top decile, the 10th decile, the highest income earners, earned about $73 billion of that $173 billion. So what you have here is they earn about 42% of all the income that's attributable in Minnesota. If you look at the total amount that's paid in taxes, the total taxes paid in Minnesota in 2008 from all these different sources I just mentioned was almost $20 million, about $19 billion. And of that, the top 10th decile paid about $7.5 billion, or about 37%. So the top 10th decile earns about 42% of all the income in the state, and they pay about 37% of the taxes, which converts to the 12.3% of the total income for the middle income folks of their income for taxes at about, I think it's 10.3 for the top 10%. So those are the sort of the relative values that we look at in terms of trying to measure the tax burden and how that's distributed based on income. If you take a look at Oregon and Maryland, I think the number one thing that we found, the variable in Maryland and Oregon, was the recession. What really happened was that there weren't, we don't know what, we were unable to determine, and they haven't been able to determine as far as we can tell, that there was a flight of wealthy people out of the state. But the fact of the matter is, in 2008, 9, and 10, right after these changes were made, there were people who were making a lot less money. So, of course, through the recession, they're not going to get the same kind of money that they anticipated, because, in fact, the economic recession really took the starch out of a lot of earnings for a lot of people at that time. So I think one of the things that what we're trying to talk about when we talk about the incidence and the fairness of the overall tax burden is that in the sense of trying to make it so that everyone pays about the same amount of percentage of their income to state and local taxes. And this proposal that the governor has would not equalize that even. It would just make it, it would be a step in that direction. The overall, you know, incidence of the or progressivity of the governor's package really is the fact that clearly the progressive elements of the fourth tier add more progressivity to the income tax system. They add more progressivity to the overall system. The property tax rebates are a progressive element of the governor's package. The rate reduction from 6.875 to 5.5% is a progressive element. The regressive elements are the base broadening under the sales tax and also the cigarette tax. So it's this combination of factors that we tried to weigh, and the overall package that the governor put together, it does have a what we call a positive suits index, in the sense that a 1.0 is a positive, totally positive index, and a negative 1.0 is a minus. Well, the governor's package comes in the positive range. Right now, our overall system is a negative. I don't have that percentage in front of me. But so this clearly, the governor's package would clearly take the overall system and make it more progressive, and the governor's package itself is a progressive proposal. So I think those are some of the issues that we tried to look at. In Snowbird proposal, the governor, part-year resident, what the governor did ask that we include that, and that is where someone who has an abode, who maintains an abode in Minnesota or a house or an apartment, and that's here for more than 60 days but less than 182 days, would be required to pay tax on that income while they're a resident in Minnesota. They currently already, anyone that pays, that's a non-resident, pays tax on their Minnesota-sourced income. This would only include the additional income, their other income, only for the time that they're in Minnesota.
Senator Artman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, the tax incidence study that you're referring to shows that Minnesota's income taxes already progressive, but it didn't include the federal tax burden, so that those upper deciles paid income taxes to the federal government in a progressive nature, and those people in the lower deciles didn't pay either. And so it actually is more progressive, which is why we insisted in 2011 in adding the federal taxation burden into the tax incidence study. And so the new one will show that it's even more progressive than we knew before. And when you add in the new income taxes at the federal level for 2013, it's going to be even that much more progressive. I think adding another income tax burden to Minnesotans is not a good idea. I think everybody's aware. I don't agree with that. But I think it's piling on. Secondly, it's ridiculous to think, and I'm not sure who said it, that businesses don't make decisions based on tax policy. They absolutely make decisions based on tax policy. And the proposals from the governor to eliminate the FOC.
Senator Artman, to that, I think sure. that the statement wasn't that they didn't
they
make
don't. They shouldn't.
It is maybe not their top priority.
Well, Mr. Chair, reality is reality.
Mr. Chairman, I made the statement, and Senator Ortman, the statement was state tax policy should not have as its purpose influencing the choice of business organization. I'm not saying that, I didn't say that businesses don't take that into consideration as they organize. They certainly do. But the state tax policy should not exacerbate that that decision so that it becomes perhaps the only thing that they consider. So it's not that they don't. It's just that the state should not get in the way any more than it has to, federal government as well, with regard to that decision.
Senator Artman.
Well, Mr. Chair, with respect to formation, that may be true, but it's certainly not true with respect to investment, because the investment decisions of businesses in Minnesota are going to be made with a large part due to our tax policy, and the governor is proposing to change C corporation taxes by eliminating some of their deductions and making Minnesota less competitive for some of our largest employers in the state of Minnesota. They're not going to want to invest here if they can get better tax treatment in another state, and they're not going to bring their earnings from overseas back to Minnesota if they can do that in a more effective, cost-effective way for their business elsewhere. Why would they expand here? Now, there may be some good reasons to do that, but if we pass tax policy that discourages that, that's harmful for our big businesses, for the small businesses that provide goods and services to those businesses, and to all the employees that work in those businesses. I think it's counterproductive if we care at all about competitiveness and about the economy. And the third thing that I wanted to say about the snowbird tax, and I'm concerned about that one too, I think we probably will lose some Minnesotans, but I'm wondering if the Department of Revenue has done any analysis of the constitutionality of the question, and if so, if you could share that information. If not, I think it's probably time to look at whether or not that's constitutional.
Commissioner France.
Mr. Chair, Senator, well, regarding the constitutional issue, it's clear from this Minnesota Supreme Court case that we reviewed was, and that is, so long as the taxation is related to the time of a resident in the state, it passes constitutional muster. The point being that if you're going to tax someone from being in the state, it has to be based upon their connection to the state. There has to be a physical connection, economical, physical connection to the state. And based upon that analysis, we have looked at the constitutionality, and we conclude that it is constitutional because of that direct connection. With respect to the investments
and
businesses.
Excuse me. Can you share the analysis with me?
Senator Artman. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scherr.
Thank you.
I'm glad to do that. With respect to the investments, I think it's important from our point of view to really divulge our input in terms of the governor's package and the administration in terms of the information we had from businesses around the state, and that is their number one investment decision is based upon the state, and the state is a complex organism for every business person. Listen, the first thing I really want to say is my respect and admiration for business people, because they are the folks who take their money or borrow money and invest it on what they think is going to be a profitable venture. Now, it's not always profitable, we know, but it's a very sobering thing to do, and I respect people for doing that because they have ideas, they have products, they have services that they think they can go to market, and going to market is the ultimate test. And so I think we all owe an sense of admiration for business people and their ability to invest and make risk, because it's all about risk. And when I was running a small business, it was so interesting to me to realize that you're risking not just your own capital or the capital of your business partners or investors or shareholders, but you're also risking the lives and values of those people who work for you. So it's really, in my mind and the people that I've talked to, a very complex decision about where to invest and how to invest. And one of the things that we heard from a lot of different people was that they want to invest in Minnesota, but they want to make sure Minnesota is going to invest as well. So, I mean, the governor's talked a lot about how even though we're at a higher level, I think the state ranking that he got from the foundation of the Taxpayers Association was 15th or 17th highest taxes, but our, you know, per capita income is number 11. So if you look at the states with the lowest tax rates or tax burdens in their state, you'll see the lowest economic growth. You'll see the lowest per capita income. So we're not a low-tax state. We haven't been for many, many years, but we believe we're a high-value state. And what the businesses have been telling us is they want to see investments in Minnesota so that the educational system here is top flight, so that they can get health care for their employees, so they can get their product to market on the infrastructure or through the internet or whatever. And so they're very, very focused on, is Minnesota the right place for me to grow my business? And if so, why? Now, obviously, taxes are a part of that equation, and you wouldn't be a very smart business person if you didn't consider how taxes are going to affect you. And we know that they do, and we have this discussion with all sorts of people. But we believe that in terms of trying to put together a budget that shifts the burden and makes it, we think, more fair, that this is what businesses are looking for to invest in Minnesota. They'll see that this state's on a path of economic stability, on economic growth, on enhancing our educational system. And one of the things that they often look at in terms of taxes is what's fair. So you're right in the sense that some of the business deductions, and this is sort of my hopefully segue into the corporate income tax section, but the business tax breaks that we eliminate are shared by just a few corporations. But, you know, I've talked to a lot of those corporations, and, you know, the thing is, they get the deduction, but their vendors don't get the deduction, their suppliers don't get that deduction or credit, and so everyone else pays a higher rate. So it's true that these deductions and breaks help some companies, but overall, if we eliminate some of these deductions and credits and lower the rate for all Minnesota companies from 9.8% to 8.4% is a pretty clear message, and there will be a lot of Minnesota corporations who are going to pay less income tax because of the rate reduction. And I think one of the things that we have to look at is, does it make sense to continue having tax breaks for a few corporations when, if we can lower the tax rate for all corporations and make the system more simple, isn't that a very competitive sign? Because the other thing that we heard a lot from businesses was, we want a level playing field. We want to have the opportunity to go out there and compete with everybody else with the same rate and the same simple tax system as possible. So that was also part of the rationale for how we came up with both the income tax proposal here and the corporate income tax proposal that I'll go into maybe after a question from Senator Hartman.
Members, I've got two people on the list, and we're going to move to the sales tax provision after those two people so we can leave adequate time for that. And so Senator Nelson and then Senator Rest, and then we're going to move on.
Chairman Skoy, I'll pass. My question was a long time ago over different topics.
And
different
members, issues. We're going to have these bill language in front of us at some point, so we're going to have a lot of opportunity to delve into that. Senator. Well,
Mr. Chair, to that point, Minnesotans have questions about what the governor is proposing. It's all over the news, and they'd like to know just a little bit more and not wait 2 weeks, because oftentimes people think this is already the law. I think we should explore it a little bit. Then we can ask better questions when the bill comes in. We can actually analyze it just a little bit better. I think it's fair to ask the governor through his commissioner what his intentions are.
Well, Senator Ehrman, I think the commissioner is going to have the department working as hard as they can to get us the bill language. Senator S.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, any number of these provisions are introduced in bills that mirror what the governor is proposing. Tomorrow, when the tax reform division will be devoting over half of the time to the foreign royalties issue, and we can ask all kinds of questions there, and we've done that already in some of the sales tax proposals. So there is ample opportunity to deal with these issues in depth one at a time before we get and understand the implications of them before we get to considering the language that is in the overall bill. So the Tax Reform Division is meeting practically every day, and certainly every time that the that the we've met three or four times, and this is only the first time that the full tax committee has met. So there's lots of opportunity for people to weigh in on any number of these issues. And what we're doing there, too, is looking at the tax expenditure budget in light of the proposals that are being made. So it's a full backgrounding in what I think eventually we'll see in the governor's language without having to wait and without also having to speculate.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Ertman,
with all due respect, you asked me last week if I thought we needed a second hearing with Commissioner France. I mean, I think it's an opportunity for us, a rare opportunity, to have a commissioner of a department with such a huge proposal before us. And I think that's, for us to engage in that conversation is very important. And I know you have other plans for the committee, but I did respectfully ask for a second hearing so we could take a little bit longer with these proposals in the full tax committee.
And Senator Armin, we will have committee time to continue this discussion. I figured it'll be more valuable to have the division meeting. They already had scheduled hearings on bills that are similar to what's in the governor's proposal, so we can delve into what the policy ramifications are. And once we get the bill language, we will devote committee time to the governor's proposal. Commissioner France.
Mr. Chair, if I might just take 1 minute and highlight some of the corporate tax and then get into the sales tax, I think there might be a few questions in the sales tax area. Just in the corporate tax area, the whole goal here was to reduce the rate and make the playing field level for all corporations. So we would take the rate from 9.8 down to 8.4%. We would take Minnesota from the fourth highest corporate income tax rate down to the 12th. And we think it makes it it's more a simple system, more fair. Now, obviously, we've asked to reduce the foreign operating company deduction, the foreign royalty payment benefits, or some of those. We also asked to change the definition of Minnesota sales group for unitary groups. We think is a fair way to look at unitary groups. We've asked for a change in the treatment of foreign partnership income and to exclude dividends from real estate investment trusts. So these are fairly minor areas. We've also asked for an economic substance test to be placed in there. This would require businesses to meet a substance over form test. For example, the two-part test would be that a business transaction must change the taxpayer's economic position in a meaningful way, and two, it has to have substantial purpose other than its tax effects. This really mirrors the federal tax law in 2010 and trying to make sure that when companies engage in transactions, there's a real economic reason to do so. Almost all the money, well, 99% of the revenue generated from eliminating the deductions goes toward the rate reduction. We felt this was an important signal for the business to use that money directly for rate reduction. I'm going to jump into the sales tax so we can keep going.
Just briefly, Commissioner, could you give us the revenue impact of the corporate tax rate change?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Go to page on the policy aids and changes, corporate rate was on this second page toward the bottom there. What would happen in fiscal year 14 and 13, there would be a combined revenue generation of about $318 million from the overall elimination of the credits, and virtually all of that would be used for. That's the rate reduction.
Expansion.
Sorry, the $318 million is the rate reduction cost. On the next page, the $322 million is the amount that we would get from eliminating the tax breaks. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner.
In the moving on to the sales tax area, the governor's proposal is to do what many have tried in the past, but haven't been able to do, and that's to expand the base and lower the rate. This is nothing new. In fact, this is, as I've mentioned to some of you before, I've got a stack of tax reform commission reports and suggested ideas, and the expansion of the base and lowering the rate is in virtually every proposal that we've seen in the last 20 or 30 years. The key was trying to figure a way that we could do it and lower the rate significantly enough to make a real difference to our ranking, if you will. We have the seventh highest sales tax rate in the country right now, statewide sales tax rate. This would drop us down to 27th. We'd be in the bottom half of those states with a sales tax rate. Now, what would happen is obviously we would expand the sales tax into new areas at the same time lowering the rate. Now, the rate reduction to 5.5% is significant and really makes a tremendous difference in terms of what this would do for the average consumer. And that's why it's so important, I think, to break this apart, because the rate reduction is a progressive has a progressive effect. So by lowering the rate to 5.5%, 56% of all of our sales tax comes from consumers right now. 44% of the current sales tax revenue is generated by businesses. So right out of the gate, what you have here is this rate reduction is you have a benefit to consumers. And as we look at consumer buying and consumer purchasing patterns, we see that the 5.5% rate reduction is significant enough on what people are currently buying that is currently taxed, that rate reduction would offset the increased taxes they would pay on the rate expansion. Remember, this is for the typical consumer. So that is one of the reasons why when we added, for example, the clothing into the mix at $100 an item or above, part of that also was trying to make sure that what we considered the necessities or the smaller items would not be taxed at the clothing level. Once again, was trying to make sure that the middle class family or the typical consumer would not see an overall net increase in sales taxes that we paid. I'll talk about what happens with the business-to-business taxes in just a moment. So really, this whole idea was to make sure that we expanded the base sufficiently so that we could lower the rate. The other thing that I want to mention about the lower rate, and that is that it really, I think, helps the overall competitiveness of Minnesota's economy. Because when you think about our neighboring states, the states are 4 and 5% around us. I think Iowa might be 6%. So right away, the 5.5% puts us in the same area as our neighboring states. This would occur on January 1, 2014. And the reason for the delay is it would take some time to implement this and make sure that we went through the process of educating the public. We would also, some of you will be aware, we'll have to make a change in the legacy of funding for this. The current constitutional language requires that if the base of the sales tax and use tax is changed, the sales and use tax rate in this section may be proportionally adjusted by law to within 0.001% in order to provide as close to the same amount of revenue as practicable. So what we've done here is the state general sales tax levy would be 5.266. The legacy amendment would be 0.234 to get to 5.5%, and that would generate about the same amount of money for the legacy funds that we currently have. In addition, we would expand the sales tax to include affiliate nexus for those companies that have an affiliate or a sponsor in Minnesota. They would be required, such as Amazon, to collect the local sales tax. We can't solve that big internet problem. We need Congress's help for that. But we would include digital goods and direct satellite services. So we would also enhance what's defined as a good to make it more consistent with current policy. I've been criticized about the digital goods because I personally don't know how to download digital goods, that I've made that exemption just for me. But I can assure you, I promise I'll try to learn how to download something digitally so I can pay on that as well. But we've also tried to make sure that the expansion goes to a range of services that include consumer services. And there, in your packet, there's a chart toward the back of the packet that starts out modernizing our sales tax. And I think you'll see a list of what's currently exempt that would remain exempt, some examples of the items that are currently taxable and the fact that the rate will go down on those. And then there's a list of those new services that will be added and the cost for those different services that we have in the plan. This would generate about 2.2 almost a little over $2 billion for the first biennium. And as I mentioned earlier, the expansion to business would require businesses to pay more in the way of sales tax. We all know, and I think going back to what Senator Chamberlain said earlier, we all know that business taxes are passed on, but it's a complex decision. One of the things that happens here for many businesses, they will in some cases receive a reduction in overall taxes too. I think as I was looking at the company that I used to work for in terms of a manufacturing company, we were not a big user of services, so I think our overall tax bill would go down under this proposal rather than up. So it depends on the kind of business you're in. It depends on your purchasing patterns, what you're buying, and how that changes. The addition to professional services, once again, based on fairness, that if I as a consumer are purchasing lawyer or accounting services, why shouldn't a business do the same? Now, we understand that there are concerns about how that is passed on from businesses. And, for example, we know that some of it's exported out of the state. We know some of it is in reduced profits for the owners. Some of it is in higher prices, and some of it is in lower wages. But we also know that there are those companies, like the one I discussed, would have an overall reduction. So it's going to go both ways. So this concern about pyramiding or cascading also works in reverse, too. There'll be some reductions that will occur. But I think that's part of the challenge for us to have this discussion about what makes sense in terms of expanding and how this tax will be borne by more businesses throughout the state of Minnesota, but at the lower rate. So I'm going to want to make sure we have some time for questions, so I'll stop there.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I have three questions. One, in the tax reform division, we have heard proposals dealing with the taxing of digital goods and the affiliate nexus, and I wonder if your staff can indicate whether those proposals are substantially different from what you're proposing, what the governor's proposing, or are they similar?
Mr. Chair, Senator, they're fairly similar, but we will get back to you and make sure if there's any differences on that.
And then secondly, with regard to the description of the expanding the sales tax to clothing on items over $100, is the tax to be imposed on the first dollar or on the amount over $100?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it would be on the total amount. So if you bought an item worth $150, the tax would be on the total $150. If you bought something for $99, there would be no tax on that.
And Commissioner, so the revenue estimates that we're getting or the impact reflects it that it's a tax on the total amount of an item that exceeds $100, not just on the amount over that. Our staff had a question about that.
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair.
I am right, aren't I?
Yes, that's the correct. Thank you.
And then thirdly,
we know that there are
states around.
Whoa. Let's make sure. So if I buy $150 something, it is on $150,
yes.
Not on $50.
Mr. Franz.
Senator,
okay.
That's correct.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
Senator Rest.
I think we needed to understand that. On the business to business services, people have raised issues about competitiveness with regard to, and I know you just made some comments about the cascading back and forth, but of having clients that are out of state, and it affects the competitiveness of if they have to charge a sales tax for their services. As I understand it, Iowa is a state that taxes business-to-business services, and I wonder if the department has information about how competitive Iowa businesses are with their out-of-state business relationships and whether the charging of the business-to-business services has had a negative impact on Iowa's business economy. I wonder if you all know that or if you've looked at other states. Iowa's not the only one, but it's certainly it's a border state, and so we pay attention We pay attention. You paid attention in the cigarette tax with not raising the tax any higher than what is charged in Wisconsin, for example. But have you looked at that with regard to our border states that also tax business services and what internally has happened to their economies?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Senator, in particular, we did look a lot at South Dakota, which also has one of the broadest tax bases in the country and in this region. And we did look to see what effect, if any, and we have talked with those folks. And the basic information we got from them was that they didn't think it had much of an effect at all. So, but we have all, I don't know, I'm not aware of the Iowa information in particular, but we'll look closer at. Yeah, some of these other states as we go through this in terms of finding out. You know, there's about five states that tax legal services and accounting services right now. And so the funny thing about this comparison is it gets really complicated. We'll go through this in more detail. And that is, I think it's like 47 states tax some personal consumer services, and 47 states tax some business services. The question is what and how do you compare those? And so we'll try to get some more information to show you state by state those comparisons and what conclusions, if any, we can draw from that. But it's very complex. States are very complex, and there are different tax systems, and it's hard to compare from one to the other. But we'll do our best to get that information for you.
Thank you.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, two quick questions. One I hope is yes or no. Do we know of any other states that are putting this system in place that Senator Rest asked you about, where if you get up to $101 or $100, the whole price is taxed? Do any other states do that?
Yeah.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes.
There you
go. I can give you some more information. I know you wanted a yes or no, but I can give you more.
Well, I appreciate that, and probably the information you're going to give me is the follow-up question, which is, seems to me that kind of creates some perverse sorts of pricing decisions that aren't market-driven, and how does that work?
Well, Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's an excellent question, and the $100 is where we fell. New York has, I think it's $125. Florida has something under $100. Rhode Island has another one. So there's like four different states that have this exemption amount at different levels. And it's interesting because it reduces the amount of revenue generated quite significantly. I think our estimate was under $100 million in this biennium from the clothing increase, but it would have been over $300 million if we had no limit at all. So it's this very, very significant limit. And the question becomes, Senator, should you and I open up a new tailor shop where you buy your pants and your jacket separately instead of a suit together? There, you know, when you have a number like that, there are those problems, and we've got to talk about those and figure out ways to do about it. I hope you can't go into one place and buy a shoe and then, you know, for $99 and buy the right shoe for $99 and the left shoe for $99. So, you know, there are those kinds of issues we have to be aware of and be sensitive to. And, Governor has really struggled with this. We all struggled with this, and your questions raise a good point. And I think that's something that we can talk about in this committee. We're certainly open to other ways to draw that line. But there are some practical problems that come with it.
Thank you.
Senator Artman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's one thing to talk about South Dakota, but we have to recognize that South Dakota doesn't have an income tax. And so if we're going to compare, let's really compare. I mean, it's one thing to have a very low sales tax across a very broad base, which they're used to in the state of South Dakota, but they also don't have income taxes. Secondly, I have to say I consider this very deceptive to Minnesotans. I would have been open, and I think others would have too, to the concept of lowering the rates and expanding the base. But what you're really doing is raising the rates and expanding the base. We're not reducing the rates with all of the additional revenue all the way down to where we could. Instead, you're capturing $1.5 billion out of Minnesotans' pockets when you do that in order to spend it everywhere else. And so it's not really a reform. It's just another way to balance the budget, which is how it's been operating around here as long as frankly, DFLers have been in charge. And former tax chair told me that's how they balance the budget. You figure out how much you need to spend. And then you go back to the tax bill, and you look for some service in the sales tax that you can add newly into the budget, like dry cleaning, for instances, and that will solve the hole in your spending. And that's exactly what's being done here, but it's being touted as reform, and that's the part that I consider to be a great deception. This is not a reform. There may be some elements of reform here, and there may be some improvements, but you're raising $1.5 billion in taxes. And the governor has said he wouldn't impose new taxes on the middle class. But this proposal raises taxes on the middle class and the poorest of the poor in Minnesota, just so you can turn around and give it to property taxpayers in the state of Minnesota. And I find that to be very irresponsible. And then to say it's a reform is just dishonest.
Senator Ermin, I would remind you that we also have a deficit. Commissioner Franz?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ermin.
We also have a reserve of $1.1 billion. And I would say that we're in a much better financial position now with the fiscal discipline that we've imposed over the last few years than we've been in the last 10 years. We have a budget reserve that equals the deficit. That's much better than we were before. This is not the time to raise taxes, not in this economy.
And the state's economy is growing, but not as fast as we'd like. Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think one of the keys to the governor's and the sales tax expansion is pure tax reform. There's nothing more pure in tax reform than broadening bases and lowering rates. That is the essential tool that we often use. And so that element, we think, is really critical toward the overall package. But the overall package is designed, as Chair Scoey mentioned, is to solve the deficit. And one of the things that we've been working toward, and the governor's been working very hard, is to make sure that we show Minnesotans that we can solve the deficit, and we can make investments in education and health care, and then we can pay back the schools. So this is a transparent and clearly focused attempt to make sure that we own up to Minnesotans and we pay down our deficit, we solve our investment problems in education and health care and job growth, and we solve the deficit not only for this biennium but for the next biennium, and we also pay back the entire school shift. And one of the things that I haven't mentioned thus far is the other element that we can afford in 16 and 17 in the next biennium is to bring in the capital equipment exemption, upfront exemption on July 1, 2015, because we'll have the necessary money to be able to afford that. So this is all about paying for things in a way that the public can see, they can understand, they can debate it. They may not like pieces of it, and they may not agree with all of it, but we think that they do agree with the fact that we need to reform our budget process so that we actually pay for everything, and the governor would not consider taking any money out of the reserve to pay for ongoing government costs because we need that money. And the last thing you want to do is take rainy day reserves out of a rainy day fund when it's the sun's shining, because right now we've got the money, the economy is on a path of recovery, and we think this is the time to make these changes that will fund government and fund the investments that the governor believes are important for Minnesota. Thank you.
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, it bears repeating this double taxation, the business-to-business stuff, impacts businesses, and in effect is double taxation. And, again, anecdotal information, but it bears repeating. I'm sure most people in this room understand this, and they've heard from people as well, clients and other constituents, that I spoke to someone last night. They have a service industry, and now under audit, but that's another story. But they said they are starting their turning the wheels, and they are going to consider leaving the state. Now you can all believe that or not, but it's true. Secondly, I'm going to address the complexity here. We talk about reform and simplification. That's not reform and simplification. That's really not. That's a list of exemptions still out there. Businesses, when they have to start working in all the paperwork and the administrative piece to handle this, that's not reform or simplification. There is a cost to the tax itself, the dollar amounts. But what a lot of people forget is there is a huge administrative cost to this as well. And it does not, this does not create simplicity in our system. To do your sales tax on $100, if it's over $100 on these items, it'll take a team of people, a project team, quite a long time to implement this. And those are dollars that are strictly go to the cost of the business. They don't generate any profit. So before you even institute this and this costing them money, when they start doing it, this is going to cost them tens of millions of dollars across the state to get the projects up, to program the systems, to collect this tax. So I say it's not simple. People aren't considering the true impact beyond the sheer dollar cost of passing dollars from one person to another and feeding it back down another tube. They're not considering the behind the scenes, behind the curtain costs to administer this stuff, and then they go out and audit it. This is extremely complicated and costly beyond the sheer dollars coming in out of people's pockets.
Commissioner Frank, do you want to comment?
Mr. Chair, Senator, in terms of the audit, I mean, one of the most difficult questions we get these days considers about what's in or out of the current sales tax code. And I think one of the things that we believe will help is by making it more simple, more fair in the sense of more items are included, and it will help eliminate some of these strange distinctions that we have. So we believe, and we've looked at other states and how they've implemented this procedure, so we think we can do the implementation fairly effectively here. In terms of the anecdotes, you know, I think one of the things that we often hear that I've heard from a number of different people or different anecdotes about what people are going to do or not do, and, you know, the Governor Dayton talks often about, you know, we've been hearing for 30 years that you increase any tax and everyone's going to leave. Well, you know, Minnesota is here. It's got a thriving business economy. It's got great businesses, and we can't take that for granted. We have to really be sensitive to those, the business concerns, and listen to them. No one would ever suggest otherwise. But, you know, I have the same number of anecdotes to go the other way. The number of people say, you know what, I'm really invested in Minnesota. I want to see more education. I want to see more health care, and I'm willing to pay more. So we all have our anecdotes. I understand that, Senator. But I think we have not seen any evidence in any study that shows the flight, if you will, when these kinds of changes are made. I'm not to say we shouldn't be careful and look to it. I mean, you raise valid concerns, and we want to make sure that we deal with those issues as upfront as possible.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Chairman Skoy. Commissioner, I just need a point of clarification. In your discussion response to Senator Ortman, I thought I heard you say that this tax proposal is, one, going to solve the budget deficit, make those investments or increase spending, and pay back the school shift. But my understanding of what I read in the governor's proposal is even with the increased taxes, I don't know, $3 billion of increased taxes, whatever that amount, it does not pay back the school shift. So can you just clarify that piece, please?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, yes, Senator, I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. It does pay back the school shift in the next biennium. So you're exactly correct. So we do solve the $1.1 billion deficit that we're currently facing. We make the investments that the governor has in his budget proposal, and then in 2016 and 2017, the school shift would be paid back in its entirety, but in that biennium.
And Commissioner, to that vein, do you want to talk a little bit about the importance to the state of the four-year look at our budget as opposed to the two-year look that has been going on for a number of years? And how long has it been since we've had a structurally balanced budget that goes out the 4 years? Do you know any of that information, or do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Mr. Chair, I don't know when that last one was. I know it's been a while, and that was one of the other issues that we talked about when we were getting together on the budget, and that was, you know, we just can't, and business people, you know, say this to us all the time, please look to the long term. Make your changes, make them quick, and get them in there, and then we'll deal with it. And we'll deal with it in a way, if we know what's going to happen in the next 2 or 3 or 4 years, we like that for business planning. I mean, as a business person, I mean, they're already really looking toward 2014 and 15 now for growth and investments and building and expansion. So we never thought about putting together a budget that didn't have a balanced approach for this biennium and for the next biennium. And that was one of the criticisms, as Senator Rest mentioned earlier, comments that I heard on the road was, please think long term, especially from the business people. And so that was one of the reasons we addressed the budget in that way.
Follow up.
Oh, yes, yes. Thank you, Chairman Skoy. Well, I really appreciate that focus on a structurally balanced budget ongoing, and I applaud the governor for his interest in doing that. But You know, the budget projection shows a structurally balanced budget with current law in the out biennium already. And so I'm just a little confused as to why we're continuing to increase the tax burdens, and we do have, and we're still not paying back the school shift. So it's just confusing to me because the current projections with current law, while there is a $1.1 billion deficit for the biennium we're dealing with here, 14-15, it is structurally balanced going out into the out bienniums. And so it's just, I guess, I'd want to know more about that school shift, why that is pushed out into the out biennium to be paid back. When would you be changing current law? So current law indicates that, you know, current law states that as soon as there is our reserves are refilled, our budget, our cash flow is refilled, which it now is, any additional money on the bottom line goes to pay back the school shift. And yet the governor's budget is pushing this out until the out biennium. So would you be changing current law? So when our forecast comes in February and there's more money beyond the reserves and cash flow, which are already full, are you saying that the additional revenue would not go to pay back that school shift until the out biennium?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Senator, no. If, in fact, the revenue estimate comes in where there's an additional surplus at the end of this fiscal year, that money will go toward paying back the school shift. And there's every indication that there may be some. I'm not an economist, so I'm not predicting anything. But if there is a surplus at the end of this fiscal year, it will go directly to the school payment, which will reduce the amount we need to pay back. So the governor, you're right in the sense that we have a budget deficit projected for this biennium, and my understanding was that there are still some deficits in the next biennium. But even if there was a surplus, that's not structurally balanced if you have a deficit of $1.1 billion this biennium and a small surplus, if any, in the next biennium. The governor's goal was to say, you know, we have some debts. We've got the billion-dollar deficit we have to pay back, and we have the $1.1 billion debt to the schools. We've got to pay it back. And his plan is, rather than trying to force that into this current biennium, we're hoping there'll be some additional payment, but rather than trying to solve the $1.1 billion deficit and pay back the school debt of $1.1 billion and make some investments, the numbers are hard to add up. You would have to generate even more revenue to do that. So the governor's approach is to raise the revenue to solve the $1.1 billion deficit this biennium, to make the investments and to be able to pay back the entire school shift the next biennium when we have additional revenues to do so.
Senator Sengem.
Commissioner, my understanding, if I'm recollecting, is that this proposal will bring in, I believe, $3.7 billion more, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. It probably doesn't matter to my question, but it will bring in more. And since we're tinkering with sales tax anyway, and one of the things we could probably agree around this table, at least given my 10 years here, is sales taxes on local units of government. Was that ever considered in your deliberations with respect to getting rid of those?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think it was was it 2011? 2011 it was eliminated from the townships to have to pay the state sales tax. It was considered. And once again, it was a matter of priorities and could we afford to do it. I mean, I think one of the things that we would love to have that discussion here is can we work in a way that would eliminate the local units of government from paying the state sales tax. But it was simply one of priorities, and it was not something that we could figure out a way to eliminate at this time. So it was something that's considered. There's about $2 billion in net and additional revenue that's added to the budget through this budget proposal.
Mr. Chair, to that point,
Was that $2 billion, a loss of $2 billion without doing that? Is that the net effect of taxing local units of government, $2 billion?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I know I meant I just yeah. trying to answer your initial question. In terms of the net revenue to the overall budget,
okay.
was about two.
Okay.
I don't have the number on the local units of government, but it's significant, and it's something I think we need to look at going forward.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, are you still open to do that as we progress?
Commissioner.
Mr.
Chair. At least talk about it.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a burden on local units. We understand that.
And Senator Senjam, I wasn't here when that tax was implemented on the cities, but from the discussions I've heard, I think they had a conversation at during one of the budget downturns, and the cities had the opportunity to have reductions in their aids, local government aid, or have a sales tax, and they chose to have the sales tax implemented on them. And so, you know, we can continue this discussion, but that's kind of the history of where that came from. Senator Artman.
Mr. Chair, and to that point, I think it's a great point from Senator Senjam, because it's a far more effective way of ensuring that property taxes and those burdens actually go down, because the local property or the local communities are raising property taxes to pay the state sales taxes in this very circular motion. It would be a far more effective way to ensure that that relief actually goes to property taxpayers and not just to local governments.
And Senator Artman, I fully expect we'll bring the cities and jurisdictions in, and we'll let them talk to us about what they'd like to do. You want to wrap it up, Commissioner Franz?
Mr. Chair, it's been a pleasure to bring this proposal to you. Once again, thank you for your confirmation vote, but also thank you for listening and engaging in this debate. We do encourage it, and we're open, and I hope you'll contact me directly, too, if you have questions and information that I can provide. If I haven't gotten it to you, or you need more, let me know. But we look forward to continuing this dialogue as we go forward.
And, Commissioner, I want to thank you for bringing the work that you and the governor have been doing on budget stability to the committee. For me, this structural balance, stabilizing Minnesota's budget as we look forward, it's absolutely the most important thing we can do this year. If we can get that accomplished, from my perspective, it'll be a successful session. Any other comments or questions, members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Senjam.
You know,
I'm
not sure if I missed something along the line or not, but I have never heard, nor do I fully believe I could explain exactly what a structurally balanced budget is. I think I could tell you what a balanced budget is, but a structurally balanced one is one that, you know, if I'm honest with myself, it'd be hard for me to define. Could we define that sometime?
Well,
not necessarily today.
I think, Senator Senjam, for me, what it means is we're balancing this two-year biennium, but then the next biennium is also balanced. So when you look at the out years or the tails or whatever they want to call it, that's in balance also. And that's always been part of the challenge. When one-time monies have been used to balance the current biennium, is that then the next biennium is not in balance. And that's part of the challenge that Commissioner Franz and Governor Dayton have addressed, I think, in their budget, is that the next biennium is forecast to be in balance. And it's very good from my perspective. Anything else, members? And the Reform Division, Senator Rest?
Mr. Chairman, we're meeting at 8:30 tomorrow. We'll be taking up the federal conformity bill with some amendments dealing with members' projects that were in the vetoed bill of last year, considering some of those. And then we're also taking up the so-called little cigars bill, or definition of tobacco, however you want to deal with that. And then on Thursday, we have some additional bills that we're hearing also, which are, I think, be in the governor's bill. So we are certainly open to any members of the tax committee, the full tax committee, joining in the division discussion at any time. So everybody is welcome.
Thank you, Senator Rest. And members, the tax committee is going to have a Friday meeting. I know it's a little early in session for Friday meetings, but we thought that it was important to move the health exchange provision along, and Senator Rest had worked for the Reform Division to do so. I didn't want to take those meeting days away from her. So we're going to meet Friday at 10:30.
On the 8th.
February 8th. So put that on your calendars. Thank you all. Committee's adjourned.